Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we are going to be discussing the return of former President Jacob Zuma onto the South African political scene and the forthcoming elections. I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Raph Matega, a senior expert on Southern African region politics at Geopolitical Intelligence Services. Raph, I'm delighted to have you join me today and I look forward to our conversation.
It's a great pleasure, Dr. Wangpa, and I really feel privileged to be part of this discussion here. And I'm looking forward to having a good discussion with you.
Brilliant, brilliant. So let me start off. So we've seen the former president amidst his legal challenges and political wars, he's made a comeback to the political scene under the MK party. What is your perception of his comeback? What is the significance of President Zuma coming back to contest another election in South Africa?
Well, it's quite mixed reaction to this. I mean, when I firstly heard of it, I was quite surprised because President Jacob Zuma, we still call him President Jacob Zuma because as you and I are speaking, he enjoys the perks as former president. He gets the budget, he's going around with blue lights, taxpayers' expense, because he's entitled to those things. And we thought it was done. We were never going to see him again in active politics. But interestingly, he's made a comeback, and it's not a comeback that one can ignore. We have mixed feelings about it. On first glance, one look at this thing. I mean, we are here in Africa. It means the former president is running for office again. What that means, is it bad? Is it good? The first glance is quite good because it means he's not arrested. He's not in jail. Things are normalizing. In Africa, in most cases, former president are usually in exile, and they don't see eye to eye, let alone legally try to come back to politics. But that's what we are seeing, and it's one of the fundamental shifts in South Africa's politics where I say that our politics has normalized. It's normalizing in a very interesting way. But when you look at the subtext of it, you look deep into it, you look at the man who has been to court probably more than any official in this country, on charges of corruption, on challenges to his authority in government, on challenge to his decisions, on being forced to testify before the state capture. I mean, this is a man who has been in the limelight, going to court in and out, has had a very controversial presidency. When he left the presidency, he was actually forced to resign because things were going really bad. The currency was tanking, the fundamentals were not in place. I'm not saying they are in place now, but there was a serious crisis of confidence in South Africa. And he was forced to resign. A lot of us, we thought that that's enough. The only time we're going to see him is when he comes to explain his culpability in a series of corruption allegations that emanate from his tenure. But no, that was not it. He's back. He's running a very serious political party that emanates from KwaZulu-Natal. He understands KwaZulu-Natal politics. South Africa's very interesting province here, where you could say it's highly concentrated when it comes to conflict, when it comes to political dynamism. I can even go to controversy of even saying that assassinations, political assassinations in that province, and President Jacob Zuma is coming out and saying that, wait a minute, I'm going to be part of this. I want to fix that which I could not deal with while I was still president. And those of you who feel they don't want to see me, I'm going to irritate you, and I'm going back to court. There is still a litigation on whether he can stand. Is he eligible? Because he served a jail term because of contempt of court, something he sees as a misdemeanor. I mean, I can go on for the next hour. This is a very, very interesting figure that I think his political life has captivated many, many people away even from South Africa. Very interesting. I mean, I get to travel. Most of the time I get to travel around, I get asked more about President Jacob Zuma than Mandela. I mean, I stop in Ethiopia, people say, President Jacob Zuma. I stop in Lagos, people say, hey, how's Zuma? There is just this fascination with him. And he keeps on popping up in public life.
Mm. Very interested. It seems to be a cut with nine lives or many lives. And it's been one that has drawn popular support among certain demographic, you know, as well as maybe criticism from others. So it's a polarizing figure. But like Riley said, his comeback could be one that shows, on one hand, the maturation of democracy in South Africa or Africa. It could also show how someone that has gone through corruption charges can also come back. I wanted to expatiate on how that is a necessary good force for good, his comeback, why it symbolizes that maturation, that transformation. Can you expatiate on that?
I mean, if you look at it, you don't find, I mean, we're in Africa, 30 years, most times we know that liberation parties survive for 30 years, they start falling apart. We have got our own challenge with democracy. And I think, I mean, being an observer, when I see a situation where it is actually normal for the former president or someone who has been in high office, most importantly, I mean, this is the man who is standing against his own party. That's even more significant. I mean, You see the former president not just standing, but as an opposition. That, for me, it's quite a significant milestone in South Africa's politics. And I think we are looking into another interesting elections in Botswana coming in October. We have also former president Mr. Khama wanting to stand as the opposition against his former party, BDP, which happens to be a liberation party. He also served within that. So beyond just South Africa, I'm seeing very interesting regional trends here, that it's not a taboo to be an opposition, to a point where people, leaders who have had their career cemented within liberation politics, whose moral, I'll say moral basis of their politics is cemented within founding parties that actually are larger than life. And now you have those presidents, I'm naming here Mr. Zuma, I'm naming in Botswana Mr. Khama, they are now standing as opposition parties. Actually, they are saying that, wait a minute, there is a lot of things we did wrong in government, or we left to the amateurs. We want to go back and fix it. How normal and how exciting does it get? In Brazil, which is another interesting country in terms of the dynamism of the politics that we share with the Africa as we form the state, Lula da Silva, he came back. I mean, what are we seeing here? It's very interesting. And for me, I would say, look at Trump as well. What are we saying here? I'm not trying to pull all this together, but I'm saying it's difficult just to look at all this in isolation. And in Africa as well, we should be proud that former presidents are actually standing. They're just irritating, and let's leave it to the voters. It's not a taboo that they're actually coming out. We're not used to it. They ought to be in exile. Unfortunately, Khama is in exile in South Africa, which just shows you the gravity of what is happening. But Mr. Zuma is having fun going around in KwaZulu-Natal, campaigning and speaking about how corrupt the ANC is and how much he would like to fix it. I'm very happy if you ask me.
Hmm. I'll come back to the parallels, because I wanted to really talk about the parallels that Zuma has with Trump and these other, you know, presidents in other places. But let me talk about the ANC. So you talk about most liberation parties have like a 30 years lifespan when they start disintegrating and all that. So we've seen in most post-colonial states in Africa, we see post-apartheid states like South Africa, where we look at ANC, but even barring Jacob Zuma, we see that there's a problem with ANC. ANC has held on to power in the last 30 years. Everything is not rosy in South Africa. And, you know, like seasoned politicians like Zuma may want to exploit this thing. So are we saying that ANC is not fit for purpose now? Or is ANC itself, is there trouble within the ANC? Is the ANC, how much has the ANC contributed to the rise of Zuma? Because, you know, there must be something that Zuma is exploiting. You know, we begin to see, what's the crack ANC? Has ANC failed? Has it failed to transform from the apartheid time to dealing with, you know, what's in vogue? What's now? Or is it a party of the past? Has it failed to transform?
I mean, you are nailing it there. The framing of the question, they're very critical. You are talking about transformation, and this is the problem with liberation parties. I mean, most liberation parties in the region, Southern Africa Development Community, most of the government in this region are actually led by those liberation parties. It's about two countries, and I speak subject to correction to our viewers here. I think it is Malawi and Zambia that have had a sense of a taste with the opposition parties, but generally in this region, Mozambique, Namibia, Botswana. Do I need to say anything about Zimbabwe? ZANU-PF has been running the show for the last 45 years or so. And the problem is that when these parties encounter governance issues in their societies, it expresses itself in two ways. First, it is the competence of the party. As you're asking, is the ANC capable of stepping up? It's about the competence, it's about the internal structures, but owing to the internal structures and their ability to step up to those challenges, it's a big historical issue about how these parties are actually formed, the genus of these parties. I mean, I compare, you go to the tradition of the ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, you go to tradition of the African National Congress, you go to tradition of the SWAPO in Namibia. These parties tend to have the same parties that we would say are leftist parties that are organized as centrist political parties, and their policies tend to be similar. They tend to appropriate the national question, if you like, driving transformation. And it makes it very difficult for parties structured along those lines to actually transform and lead a modern democratic society that is characterized by what you can call multiculturalism, some things that are even these parties are not adjusting to, different identities that a post-liberation citizen has. So you can blame the ANC and ZANU-PF and say that, are these parties being managed properly? I then go back to be saying they are not designed to survive beyond where they are, unless otherwise they undertake radical transformation, which the ANC is trying. They talk about the renewal of the party. It's creating major problem within the party and internal division. You end up with political parties that are leading societies from behind. As societies are improvising, political projects become weak, fragmented, and you end up with the NGOs actually driving some of the progress here and there as these parties try to reinvent themselves as liberation parties. The time is gone. They cannot continue to exist in that same old way while the societies that they lead are evolving into modern societies.
In my research, especially my current research, I look at democracy, look at liberal democracy. I look at how the focus on elections and how the adoption of liberal democracy could be a problem in Africa. But from my conversation with you, I'm seeing a different light. So if you're looking at 30 years post-apartheid, now if you're looking at 60 years post-colonial, since Africa has gained independence, should we be talking about those factors? Should we not be talking about current status and be looking within, be looking at, you know, the kind of leaders and looking at how are they dealing with this. So I agree with you definitely with that. Mm-hmm. You know, there mm-hmm. might be like a change of narrative and say, you know, these parties are not fit for purpose in Zimbabwe, you know, like you've mentioned, in Namibia, Mozambique, look what's going on in Mozambique. So, you know, there should be a different narrative that we're talking mm-hmm. about. But if we look at, but also if we look at all of these newer parties like Jacob Zuma,
mm-hmm.
we see again the use of the MK, who used to be, which people see as the arm wing of ANC. Is it not the same narrative that we used to counter what we're talking about? What is new there? Rather, apart from the, you know, court personality of Jacob Zuma.
You know, Dr. Tamapa, South Africa's politics has got the problem of having all elements in it almost at the same intensity. You've got traditional leadership, you've got kings, you've got civil society, you've got vibrant politicians, you have it all. And I do think that is where the challenge becomes about the competition for these narratives as we are seeing them within our society. You're talking about the structural challenge of colonialism. I don't want to dismiss your question because it's very fundamental. I mean, how fair is it that we can define some of this problem by the challenges of the last 8 years? And this is a dilemma because the Liberation Parties, when most of them decide to go on a centrist approach to governance, it had to do with the pragmatic idea that colonialism had fragmented those societies. You need to bring them together. You find the states, you go to many other areas that some of the states you find actually artificial creation in some areas. And these parties are trying to build those societies, trying to push for national cohesion to strengthen societies in the post-colonial state. But here is the problem now. The problem becomes when the mistakes are so bad when it comes to corruption. The biggest problem that those parties have, they get into legitimacy crisis that is induced by corruption. I mean, in South Africa now, are you going to talk about transformation of the society, representation of women, representation of black people in various industries, or are you going to focus on massive looting that has resulted in electricity cut? You are competing with these things, and this is a challenge that Liberation Parties are. I often say, whenever I meet leaders who lead these parties, I often say to them that your problem that you are going to have is that when a leader with that liberation tradition comes through and the root that they have in society, when they become corrupt, when they lose legitimacy, the damage goes very deep because the project they stood for, including transformation of the society, including fighting some of the challenges that colonialism left within the society, those projects get compromised. I mean, what is the grand narrative in South Africa now? It's corruption. We just want a clean government, to a point where people might end up saying that, look, things are bad. We don't have much worry. We will worry about transformation later. And that is not, we should not be choosing between this. So the likes of the parties of President Jacob Zuma, they come back and they look at this narrative. Why do these parties gain traction? Why are they being able to stoic anti-establishment? Why are they being able to say the system as it is, it is not right? They are being able to do so because indeed the system as it is not right. In the level of inequality, the concentration of poverty among the youth, it is getting those youth to be easily agitated. And if someone is pointing to them, someone is saying to them, you are having what you are having because you are a black youth, they're going to listen. And you cannot say to that person that the person is completely being lying to them. The question becomes an issue as we say, is this person committed? Do they have a record of working for the people? Have they done it or not? We are into a whole different terrain. So the question you are raising is very fundamental. You're talking about the narrative. This is the election also about the narratives, but there is also a pragmatic issue here. It is the collapse of service delivery, which is just clear in people's eyes.
I'm happy you mentioned Donald Trump's really stands out. And there is a strong similarity between Donald Trump and Jacob Zuma. So we can see in terms of age, we talk, these are people that are quite advanced in age. And then these are people that are also exploiting all of these standing as anti-establishment, even though they themselves, you know, that is debatable, but they stand as anti-establishment. Rightly said, you know, you can see clearly what they're saying. You can dispute that you know there's lack of all of this, and but whether they are exploiting that for their own personal gain is another thing. And they've also been facing charges, criminal charges, corruption charges, but they've managed to stay afloat of this. So I think what I'm looking at is, what does this portend for? Because you see, it's not just in South Africa, it's not just in the world. What does this portend for democracy, for democratic growth? Like, are we saying, I remember, you know, when we started, we talked about Jacob Zuma's return has some positive in terms of, you know, how it's impact on democracy. But if we're looking in terms of like the age, looking at, you know, fighting criminal charges and all those things, what impact does it have, long-term impact does it have on a young democracy like South Africa, or young, you know, Byron, looking at it from post-apartheid, on Africa as a whole, the continent as a whole, what impact does it have?
I mean, what you're pointing out goes beyond the continent. It's the crisis of liberal democracy. I mean, you see, the problem is that you cannot continue.
You keep talking, I can hear you, it's gone. Yeah.
Yes, you cannot continue saying things are normal at the center while the level of exclusion it's growing. I mean, women now are coming out and asking very deep questions about whether the construct of liberal democracy as it is, you know, rights discourse and so forth, does it really protect and ensure their inclusion? And you've got women, and it's not just women. You've got many other groups. You've got your LGBTQ groups. You've got a whole lot of identity politics that is coming out. And why identity politics coming out? Why people are saying that, look, you are discriminating us, you are excluding us on the basis that we are part of this distinct group, or we are part of this distinct political or social community. It is a crisis of liberalism. In the US, it shows how the comfort on Main Street, the comfort in Washington, it's not workable, because Trump is being voted by people who are now long are having a problem with what is going on Main Street. People are saying that, ironically, is that Trump is an elite himself, and he's actually saying that what is happening in Washington, it is just elites who are doing everything else against you, ordinary, hardworking Americans. And Mr. Zuma comes out as well, the same, as a political elite as well, and he will go talk to the poor that are desperate. Why is such politics possible? And I've written quite about populism in the past, and people always see populism as an anomaly. And I always say that, no, it's not an anomaly. It's actually a correction of liberal democracy. The question is, with all these questions that are being asked by the likes of Mr. Zuma's party, by the anti-establishment political parties that come out, not just Mr. Zuma, Economic Freedom Fighters as well, another interesting party that boldly comes out and say that what is happening at the center of South Africa's politics is not fair, it's not ethical, it is just an agreement that is just, you know, to the disadvantage of majority of South Africans, and therefore the party pontificate majority of Black South Africans. And I'm waiting for the time such kind of discussions are irrelevant in our societies. As much as I have a problem with people who are using those discussions to stoic, sinister political gains, I'm still left as a political analyst, as a political scientist, I'm still left with a very uncomfortable question that says, why in my society will people still listen to that? Why should we still have people who feel they don't have a stake in this system? I mean, I witnessed anger in townships where people protest and they will burn City Hall. And I ask myself, what happened to that time when someone does not feel City Hall is part of them? What would have happened around that time? And we must deal with these questions without necessarily destroying the system that we have. I have to be honest. I mean, we're talking liberal democracy, we're talking right discourse, liberal either with a uppercase L or short case. The reality is that we more or less agree on the type of society we want, the rights and so forth. And I do think with inclusion of more people, we are going to see some of the radical parties ceasing to exist. But as long as there is a distinct, a clear exclusion of groups in our system, it is going to be a challenge. And all of this is the challenge of the mainstream, actually.
Talking of inclusion and talking of you know, groups, in Africa, I think Africa has the highest youth population. And and then populism as well is not just from looking at the, you know, elderly's like a Zuma community. We recently saw in Senegal, we saw the youngest elected leader in Africa, you know, Faye, in this recent election. Do we see it as a reverser of the trend? Does that present some sort of hope, some sort of a challenge to the old order? Does it say, because in South Africa, for instance, and I've seen a lot of what you've written, or you've written a lot on the discrimination, on the you know, whether at the racial level, whether at the, you know, social economic level and all of that. So, but and the demographic that's always been excluded and borne the brunt of this. And if when it comes to the violence that you're talking about, destroying town, city, or it's also the youth that are participating in this destruction. So how do you see this? You know, how does the Senegal case, does it present hope to the youth that, you know, our voice can be heard? You know, we can play. How much are they playing? Why is it Jacob Zuma that is coming up? Why, you know, we've seen Malema, Julius Malema's Easter is where he's, you know, with the party. Do we see any shift, any pragmatic shift
with
in the center role?
Yeah, I think you look at President Jacob Zuma, you look at President Cyril Ramaphosa, you look at leaders of other opposition parties. It is not a rule that they are younger, still an exception for them to be young. And that is where it is. I remember when I wrote in 2018, the average age of a political party leader, I placed it at 62, 61 years, somewhere there. And that still looked better. But when I look at it now, the youth dividend, the role of the youth, you see, we should also be careful of our societies are also very complex as well. As much as we admire liberal democracy and so forth and vibrancy in leadership, we are conservative societies. And when I say we are conservative societies, it is to say in South Africa, if you look at most institutions that are outside government, other institutions of leadership are traditional leadership institutions. They are not led by the youth. They're usually led by tried and tested. As you know, you will read in many novels. That's just what it is. And you have political leadership in South Africa very much connected also to that institutional culture as well. And you have younger people coming out. If you look at parties that have been formed by younger people in South Africa in recent times, you'll realize that they are very disrespectful young people who broke away from main parties. It's Mr. Malema, it is Musima Emani, you name them, who, you know, left bigger parties and probably they felt they could not move. So what am I saying? We are conservative, but we are also changing. We are not static. You know, I don't know if the pace is sufficient, because you look at the number of voters, usually are going to be highly youth. But also, if I further disaggregate and go into the gender, we should be having more women as candidates. I mean, a week ago, I was at a conference. There was the chief electoral officer who stated statistics about representatives. And interestingly, the number of women who have registered to vote is higher, and you can say disproportionate to the candidate. You've got fewer men who are going to vote, more men who want to lead. You see? So those things, I think, as these pictures are painted to us, you can see a shift, but you can see also that we need to do more work. Because we are battling that that culture, our culture, we are quite conservative. We come from those culture where we don't challenge the elders. I mean, I can disagree with the elder in parliament, the demeanor and everything. I mean, it worried me. I wrote about it sometimes that sometimes Malema would look at the South Africa's leaders will look at Mr. Malema and they will comment that, but he's disrespectful at the way he's talking to elders. But when he's saying to them they are sleeping in parliament, he's a representative and they're actually taking a nap, and he's just outlined the fact. You see that cultural clash. But I do see something very interesting, that there is a shift and there is no generation that owes another space. Young people need to get up as well. The older generation, I don't believe they owe it to the younger generation that they need to give it to them on a silver platter. They need to go out there and demonstrate that they actually are worthy of being leaders, and that's what we need to see across the continent.
I like how you balance the arguments. You mentioned something about exclusion, and you know, we need to have social mobility, we need to have access for young people in this party, see where they can grow and where they're not frustrated. And you know, but then again, I like how you say, you know, nobody's gonna give you that. You need to prove yourself, you know, in a setting where you can then have that access. You can't sit down and just expect to be given such privileges. I like how you balance. And then again, that culture.
And if I go further, what I say to the youth, I mean, I'm no longer a youth, I'm out of that. So that's why you can always say,
I don't know, because in Africa, they say, at least you're still a youth, you know?
Yeah. What I say to the youth, I always say to our youth in Africa that they need to take things seriously, because decisions that have been taken today, it is the tax that they're going to pay for it. I mean, the decision taken today is a tax. So I always say to the youth in Africa that they have to balance their own life. They have to actively go into politics and demand their own space. When I say demand their own space, I'm saying claim it legitimately. If the youth want to position itself as a youth that is going to entertain and it will be its sole place to be entertainers, then they must be ready to consume the political decision by their elders and live with them and pay for them in time to come. It's just how they reflect, and it is their space to claim. They must go claim it. Nobody's stopping them. They need to understand it's not going to be given to them.
I like how you punch out this argument with also showing some new trends. So like you said, in South Africa, you look at the electorate and see that more women, and I think traditionally more women, and look at the demographic, all the women, even in America, they usually the ones that go out to vote on the day of the vote. But I think we're seeing a change, because in Nigeria, the last election, we saw the youth come out en masse, you know, young youth, 18, that have never voted before, to come out and vote. We're seeing the youth taking charge, even sometimes, even in a misguided way, maybe in the Francophone countries, you know, but still see youth gaining a bit of political consciousness in Africa, though it's not to the level where we want. How do you see all of this playing out on May 29? How do you see all this play now?
It is difficult to see South Africa's youth as constituting a distinct vote. I do not see the youth as a factor that is going to drive these elections. I mean, this is because from the distance, you look at it, I don't know, it might look like South Africa is burning, but youth, they're just on their social media getting by, going to college and all the stuff. I see it with my son, who is a young man. He doesn't talk much about that politics. He talks about it, but it's quite a different. The youth are not so politically conscious as it's not a 1976 youth, and let us not get nostalgic here. This is the youth that can walk into Sandton. This is the youth that can, even if some still have some systematic problems in attaining those places realistically, but these are the youth that are living under completely different circumstances. The social space within which they exist does not build so much pressure that they have to feel the political pressure as a necessary way of. It's not like that. Back in the days during apartheid, apartheid regulated all aspects of life, social, political, and also. That is why you have had so much pressure that you put the youth in that cooker. You created just a youth that were ought to have been so conscious there was no other way. That's not the case today. The youth are doing their things and they're involved in other organizations. They've got representations and all, you know. So it's not the same youth. And we should not blame them too much. These are the youth that when they go to, the children when they go to university today, they learn how to code. They learn how to code computers and all that. We didn't do that when we did that. So we've got to understand that their consciousness will be different. They'll be preoccupied by other things. And in South Africa, I really have to say, I cannot talk about a distinct youth vote. I don't think so. I mean, the EFF, for example, they are cutting the youth vote. I would say they are stagnant because you just reach diminishing returns on that. You are radical trying to agitate the youth. Where do you stand? You stand at that 10%, and that's just about it. So where, if you really want to go into the mainstream in South Africa, identifying the youth vote as a distinct vote, it just might be a fruitless exercise.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned EFF having, you know, voting standard at 10%. But and ANC, I don't have the majority except one time where they lost that majority. What with the incursion of the MK and Jacob Zuma, sometimes we focus on Jacob Zuma and the MK. There are other parties, like Bradley mentioned as well, that are challenging the ANC.
Yes.
What do you project? Do you see ANC losing its majority hold? Do you think it might have be forced to form a coalition government? What do you see moving forward?
I mean, if you look at the trends, you look at how the ANC has been declining. I mean, where are they now? Something like you are in the 50s, they've crossed from 60% to 57. And if you look at different regions, KwaZulu-Natal, where MK Party is being formed, it has got its own regional dynamics. That's the area that the ANC could not claim even from the get-go. It was under the Inkatha Freedom Party far back, IFP, the late Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi. Then Mr. Zuma gained prominence within the ANC. And when Mr. Zuma started working for the ANC a lot in KZN, one of the dissidents was the ANC regaining control of the province from Inkatha Freedom Party. Now Mr. Zuma is back. He's running his own party, no longer the ANC. It means the ANC is actually very weak in KwaZulu-Natal. They will most likely lose that province. The Western Cape province is a province that is already run by the Democratic Alliance. Gauteng province, I just want to give you a quick regional map. Gauteng province is very interesting, Doctor, because Gauteng has got a lot of dynamism. KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng are the two provinces with the highest number of voters. Gauteng being high and then KwaZulu-Natal being the second highest. So the mathematics tell you that these two provinces are going to be able to carry whoever. If you have major losses in those provinces, you are going to feel it nationally. They carry the highest number in terms of proportion. Zuma is cementing himself in KwaZulu-Natal. So there will be a lot of fragmentation in KwaZulu-Natal. It will be difficult for any party to win KwaZulu-Natal outright. It will have to go into coalition that province. Province of Gauteng, Gauteng, it is the center of the emergence of new parties. Why, Doctor? It's because Gauteng would be like Abuja or Lagos. If you are there, you can reach many people within the shortest space of time. The media is concentrated there and everything. So if you are campaigning, that's where you are putting a lot of your money, in Gauteng. It means the competition will be very fierce. The numbers are showing that the ANC will not likely win Gauteng. Then at national level, a different story. You've got the Democratic Alliance, which is actually one of the most skilled opposition parties. It came from, it used to be called something like, it had a name before. It used to be called Democratic Party of some sort. There was a merger. But this is the only party in post-apartheid that has got a long-sustained tradition of opposition. Having transformed from the old opposition to now, it is now sitting at 20%. So it is a big challenge to the ANC. It does not stand a good chance of winning, but I think they can inflict a damage if the ANC is driven below 50 plus one, because they need 50 plus one which will be that majority to form government. If the ANC is at 43%, it still means numerically, mathematically, they stand a good chance to form the coalition. So if we look at this election, it's not about opposition parties coming and being strong because they've been very fragmented. This election is about a political fragmentation whereby voters are throwing their votes all over, taking them from main parties. There is no main party that is expecting significant growth. That's the problem. And new parties like Zuma's party you are mentioning, it, let's say Zuma's party comes out to, it has been polling at, you are 7, you are 10%. That's quite significant for a party that is not. But where will that 7% come from? It's going to be coming from the radical side as well, the leftist, the EFF, because they fish in the same pond, the ANC as well. Zuma is not going to take members from or voters from the Democratic Alliance. No. He's going to be shopping on that side. So that's why you're going to see more of political fragmentation. 1% are there, 2% are there, a lot of big parties sitting at 15%, not knowing what to do with it. And ANC, I don't think ANC will be interested in going into a coalition with a strong partner like the EFF. I think if you're a stronger partner, you need weaker partners for coalition. You get smaller, 2%, and then you cut them a sweetener here and there, a minister's position, and a little bit of a concession on one or two. And smaller parties usually, they don't have policy concessions that are difficult meet.
So it's quite clear and one can clearly say that this coming election is going to change the political landscape of South Africa. But before we come to the last question, how does this contribute? Does this, what will this have any impact on the advancement of democracy and governance issues? So, because in the last many years, we've seen a lot of South Africans frustrated with governance, like when I say cut of electricity, things are getting so bad. So with this help, with this kind of competition that has been introduced, we did have to spark some sort of people-oriented kind of like policies. Where do you see this political landscape? What impact do you see? Is it going to be negative or positive?
I'm glad you raised that question, Doctor, because it will be very positive. You see, coalition government, if they come after concentration of power that has resulted in abuse, coalition therefore signifies that deconcentration, diffusion. And coalition, you know, I've written a chapter. We had this chapter coming out, Doctor. We wrote this book. We'll send you a chapter, or maybe we'll find a way to send you a copy. Yeah. We'll send you a copy sometimes. I wrote a chapter in this book. It is edited by a few professors. What I argued in this chapter was to say that even if partners have got bad intention, coalition shapes them towards cooperation, the advancement of democracy. The first thing that coalitions are going to do is that you are going to force policy to go through various iterations. If policy was going through one place, now it has to go through two, three. It will never come out the same. It should not come out the same after being discussed by them. It doesn't mean this coalition are going to work from day one. No, we have crisis, no doubt. They're going to go through their testing process. Government might fail. Budget might not be passed. I know how difficult it is to pass the budget when you have this. But I can tell you that the medium term progress on this thing is that we are going to learn the culture of co-governance. The culture of co-governance is the most important thing. It involves concessions as a way of making decisions. It actually means the culture of reaching out, because we are where we are. The ANC is governing with over 60% of support. And you tell me what happened. I don't need to tell it to our viewers what happened. They go make their own analysis on what has happened, on some of those policies that... Some of the policies you could say a party, and I don't blame the ANC because it is the voters who give the party that support. So I believe in co-governance, and I really think that we should not set up our parties in a way that when they fail in their political project, they've got such high majority, it looks like the failure of entire national project. It should not be. I mean, we should be talking about the ANC struggling to hold on here. We should not be talking about instability, South Africa, you know, unprecedented elections, this and that. Why should this be unprecedented? How many countries have had democratic elections before us? What is new here? It should not be anything new here.
So to conclude, you know, we've seen elections in South Africa. I think you mentioned there's a forthcoming election in Botswana as well, and there's also the kind of like Trump in Botswana. But how do you see South Africa election presenting itself as a litmus test for the kind of change or pattern or whatever we're going to see? How do you project Africa? We see, you know, we're seeing like a wave in Africa where.
Yeah,
on the side of the Sahel and former Francophone countries, you're seeing return of military rulers. On the other side, like South Africa, we're seeing this. So, what is the future of Africa, continent-wide? If you look at South Africa, how does South Africa, you know, does it present itself as an example or as a litmus test for the continent? Where do you see the continent? You know, where are we headed?
When I look at the region, I look at what's happening around the region, and I look at South Africa. I look at where South Africa is. And, you know, I'm very critical of the ANC. I've never felt unsafe. And I can say whatever I want to say to ANC leaders. That's one of the great things about being in South Africa, is that even when things, we have got our challenges, we are sticking to this democratic principle. We have got challenges. They are there, but we are not a closed society. We speak quite openly. And one thing I can say about the ANC is that the ANC is not in charge of the Western Cape. And that's where Parliament is actually sitting, for people to know. South Africa's Parliament sits in the province of Western Cape. And the ANC is not running government there. It does not even run the city there. But things are fine. And the ANC is not really such a bad opposition. They have not behaved badly where they've been in opposition. You see, I've been critical of liberation parties. Now I'm pointing quite positive about the experience we've seen here with the ANC. And to say that at some point they don't run the city of Johannesburg, which is one of the biggest budgets on the continent. And they were fine knowing that they lost elections. There is no party that has won it. And the city where I'm sitting now, east, where the airport is, Over Tambo and all, Johannesburg International, it's run by coalition government. So these things look very scary from a distance, but we can live within this system where there is an exchange of power and institutions become stronger, so that when power alternates, it does not necessarily mean we stop providing public service as the public service. And I'm very positive that there are good examples here. There are some challenges. There are good examples on the continent. I don't want to talk about the outliers in the Sahel region, about the coup d'etats and that area there. That's not to bring in the discussion. But when I look at what's happening on the continent, I look at what's happening in Nigeria. I mean, I traveled Nigeria in 2003. I've had talks with people now. When I read, when I talk to people, the discussions I'm having with colleagues that side and the media and the push against corruption and everything. And despite everything else, civil society, I'm happy we're headed in the right direction. I mean, it's not going to be easy. And it comes down to that thing. Remember, you are not just dealing with corruption. You are also dealing with the institutional and the business culture, some of which come from colonialism that has infused itself into the new ways and in a very parasitic way, has survived through. So these are complex things that we need to take our time and stay resolute. So I'm very positive that no one on the continent, I think there are very few people, doctor, who will sit with you and challenge you that they don't want democracy. I think there are very, very few. They might give you adjustment of what they want, but you are going back to those people saying, we want democratic system. And I think that's how far we've come.
Yeah, Dr. Matega, thank you very much. I share your positivity and I share your perception regarding, you know, what people want, even in those outliers like you mentioned. Yeah. If you ask the citizens, They want democracy. Everyone wants democracy. Democracy, they better be in a place where you can voice your, you know, have your voice, you know, expressions, express yourself. Right? Thank you for this, you know, great insights into, hopefully we'll call you back after the elections and see.
Yeah, we will talk. We will talk. you guys, and I enjoyed the conversation. And then I really also appreciate very thought-provoking questions, Doctor. And I really enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, same here. And have a very great day. And we'll keep you posted. Once this episode is published, you would keep in touch. And hopefully you can help us share this among your network as well, so they can have access to it. All right. Thank you very much. And have a great, great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. I want to thank Dr. Ralph Matega for his very, very useful insight into South African politics and the return of President Jacob Zuma. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I do, and I encourage you to come back again next week for a more exciting episode. Until then, see you.